We have been looking at the book of Daniel, and we spent a couple of weeks looking at the background setting and all of that so that we would have a kind of understanding of the significance of what he has written. And in our study last time, we set forth the idea that the big issue in verses 1 and 2, which is introductory, in fact, the whole first chapter in some senses is introductory because it was written in Hebrew and then he switches over to the language of the Chaldeans for the next six chapters, 2 through 7. So in a sense, chapter 1 is introductory. But the first two verses, he mentions the issue of the house of God three times in one verse. And he talks about how it wasn't Nebuchadnezzar that was the one who was able to conquer Judah. It was the Lord giving Judah into his hand. So there are four references to God in verse 2. Two of them, the true God, and then a couple of them, the Babylonian God. But nonetheless, with this focus on the house of God and the issue of God, I drew the conclusion that one of the biggest issues in the book of Daniel is the issue of relating to God. That's the issue. And there is no greater issue for human consideration in light of the reality of eternity than having a relationship with God. There isn't. I mean, if you have one, eternal life is a promise to you, and you have every expectation of leaving this world behind and then forever being in the blessed situations of all that God is forever and ever, amen. But if you're not a believer, the alternate scenario is horrible because the scriptures talk about the lake of fire and how people can be in it for 1,000 years and still be there. And Jesus said on one occasion that you need to be careful because there's this fiery place where their worm doesn't die and the fire's not quenched. That goes on and on and on. So in terms of real importance, there is nothing more important than having a legitimate revelation from the true God so that we can relate to him. And then we went from there to the reality that the book of Daniel is vastly prophetic. Almost all of the information is prophetic. And we raised the issue that Isaiah makes his apologetics for how do you know that you're worshiping the right God. I mean, because everybody had their own gods, and the Jews claimed that their God was the true God. It wasn't any different than the Babylonians claiming that their gods were the true gods, or the Egyptians claiming that their gods were the true gods. And so there had to be some kind of way you could tell. And Isaiah's argument, and Isaiah in multiple places, was you can tell who the true God is if he or his messengers can tell you from the beginning how it's going to play out at the end. And if you live long enough in the time frame, a lot of the prophecies that are made are fulfilled. And if you can find somebody that can accurately tell you what's going to happen down the road, then you've run into omniscience, and that's the God. The Jews and the Gentile nations had fallen into what I consider to be a major error, in that they considered the real issue of the true God is omnipotence. And in a sense, that's valid, because the one that's got the power is the one that's going to win in the end. But the problem with omnipotence as a foundation for trying to decide whose God is God by power is that you have verse 2, Nebuchadnezzar comes to Jerusalem to besiege it under the auspices of his God. And then the Jews' God gives the Jews into his hand, and the Jews don't know God gave them into his hand, and the Babylonians don't know it was the Lord that gave them into his hand. They just assume that the God of the Babylonians is more powerful than the God of Jews. So you use power, and you're messed up. Your thinking's completely wrong. And you move that forward to some of the prophecies in the book of the Revelation, where you have the Antichrist, the final end time Satan-possessed human being ruling the world, and he is able to at least give the impression of resurrection from the dead, because he receives this fatal wound, and then he comes back to life, and then he's able to make this image of himself speak, and these are powerful. I mean, Romans 1 says that we know that Jesus is the Son of God by the power of the resurrection from the dead. Well, Satan's going to mimic that, because people are going to think, well, he's got to be God because of what he can do. This is power. And I think that's probably why Isaiah and Daniel opted for the prophetic thing. You find somebody who can prophesy accurately, and you're connected to omniscience, and if you're connected to omniscience, you're connected to the true God. So that's kind of where we were in the introductory things. Daniel is giving us a basis for believing that the God of the Jews is the true God of heaven. And of course, he's going to claim that in chapter 2. So this evening, we come to the paragraph that is contained in verses 3 through 7 this evening. So, let's just start with verse 3 and following. It says that the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom there was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court. And he ordered him to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter into the king's personal service. Now among them, from the sons of Judah, were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them, and to Daniel he assigned the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego, or Abednego as it's popularly called. So the first thing that we run into is that the king, he is identified in verse 1 as Nebuchadnezzar, and then he's just the king of Babylon. And even in verse 2, he's the king that brought the vessels of the house of God to Shinar, to the house of his God. And then verse 3, it's the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his officials, to do some things with these youth things. So I just wanted to start with the instructions to Ashpenaz and ask the question first, who was he? Who was Ashpenaz? This is the only time in the whole Bible that the name is given. So you have to ask yourself, why do we know his name? And what's the significance of the way he's addressed here? And why did Daniel particularly feel like it was necessary, for example, to tell us that he was Ashpenaz and then never mention him again by name, always by function after this? He's called, in the New American Standard, the commander of the officials in verse 7. And then he's, in this reference, the commander of the officials is found 6 times in this chapter. And then he's not mentioned again anywhere else in Daniel. And the thing that we have to ask ourselves is, what's the deal with Ashpenaz and this chief of his officials thing? Now, you notice in the King James and in the old ASV, it's not commander of the officials or chief of the officials. It's the master of his eunuchs. So we run immediately into this issue of why translators choose the words they choose. Why is he the master of the eunuchs in King James in 1901 ASV, but he is the chief of the officials when you get into the NASB? What's going on here, really? Well, what's really going on here is that the word that is translated officials is a word that comes from a verb that means to castrate, and that's why they referred to them as eunuchs. But the word had a derivative history of meaning that moved somewhat away from the idea of being castrated as a eunuch into being a special official of the king. And whether they, I mean, it's unlikely that they castrated all the officials of the king. So the line of thinking is that it just became a word that meant official rather than identifying his physical condition. So that's where there's some issues here. But I think it's necessary for us to understand why, in the first place, he's called the chief of the eunuchs or the chief of the officials in verse 3, and then the switch is to the commander of the officials in verse 7, and then in verse 8, Daniel sought permission from the commander of the officials, and in verse 9, God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials, and the commander of the officials in verse 10 said, and then verse 11, Daniel said to the commander of the officials, and then it's he in verse 14, he listened to Daniel, and then at the end of 10 days, their appearance seemed better, so the overseer continued to withhold their choice food. So what's Daniel doing here? Well, in order to answer that question, I think we have to understand the two issues that are in verse 3 as a description of Ashpenaz. We're asking, who is Ashpenaz? Well, the word that's translated chief is not the same word that's used in verse 7 for commander. In fact, in the translations here, in both the King James and the ASV, it's the prince of the eunuchs, as opposed to the master of his eunuchs. In verse 3. So, what's really going on here? Well, to start with, let's take that word chief. What does it really mean? And why then does he switch over to prince or commander in verse 7 and then keep that term all the way through? Well, it's kind of interesting. The word that's translated chief in verse 3 is not a noun in the original language. It's an adjective. And if you're up on your English grammar, adjectives modify nouns. They tell you something about the noun. The point is that the phrase, the chief of his officials or the master of his eunuchs, actually means that he was the top of the eunuchs. In other words, he was a eunuch, but he was the head one. He was the, in the King James word, the master, but being an adjective means he was the most powerful of the eunuchs in terms of rank. And so here we have the king telling Ashpenaz, who is, there's apparently a whole group of either officials or eunuchs, and we'll get to that in a minute, but that whole group has a particular guy who's at the top of the thing. It's kind of like Michael being called the archangel. He's the top angel of all the other angels. Well, this guy is the top eunuch. And the point of that is he's a eunuch or an official. So that's the first thing we have to understand is Ashpenaz had this particularly significant position under the king. And the king told him what he wanted done with these hostages he had brought from Judea, from Jerusalem. Now, the second thing that we have to understand is this word that's translated officials or eunuchs, and what do we do with this? Well, the word that's translated eunuch, as I've already said, actually had its origins in the verb castrated. And because of the way that language shifts over time, it may or may not have always maintained that particular thing. But because of the way eunuchs were originally used, they were originally used by the king to oversee the king's wives and the girls, the females in his household. Because eunuchs could be trusted not to, you know. And for obvious reasons, the king would, if he wanted to have somebody to take care of his wives and daughters and whatever, he had to be able to at least trust them not to mess around with them. So they either made a eunuch out of somebody or they took somebody that somebody else had already made a eunuch out of. But anyway, it was harmless sexually. So that's where it started. But because of the idea of him being a trusted servant of the king in relation to this fairly ticklish task that he had, over time, that may have well derived into the idea of an official that the king gave certain authority to do certain jobs with under his own authority. and they would be trusted men to do the jobs that he was assigning. That may be how the idea shifted. However, our question for this evening is, was Daniel an official, eventually an official? Was he overseen by an official, or was he overseen by a eunuch, with a fairly straightforward implication that that Daniel and his friends had been castrated? That's the question that's in front of us. So, how do we decide it? Well, if you went online like I did and just researched this thing, you'd find that there were some people who were adamant that he was a eunuch, Daniel and these other guys, because they were under the head eunuch. And there are others that, absolutely not, that's not possible, blah, 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 blah. And you look for reasons and arguments and all that, and you don't find much except for prejudicial, emotional. I don't want to think that God would let these faithful teenagers be hauled into captivity and then castrated, because they were the only ones who were being faithful. People don't like to think like that, that God wouldn't allow that to happen to them. But that's an emotional argument and doesn't hold any water at all. I mean, look, if you stop and look at the way God has allowed the most faithful of his people to be treated over the centuries, how were they treated? Bad. In fact, one of the either apostles or Jesus, I don't remember if I'm confusing Stephen's indictment or something that Jesus said, but on one occasion somebody said, "Which of the prophets have you not killed?" And you see John the Baptizer. He gets thrown in jail and then he gets his head cut off, and he's greater than any man until the coming of the Son of Man. Not Jesus said that. No man born of a woman is greater than John the Baptizer. So this whole nonsense.
Faithfulness with the hardships and suffering.
In fact, the harder the hardships are, it actually may be an indication of just how diligent God is being to try to prepare them for their place in the kingdom. And a lot of times that means an enormous amount of suffering in this present world. And you look at the cross. The most faithful.
If they were captured or made eunuchs, don't you think God would have put it in his word and let us know?
I think he did, and that's where I'm going to go next.
Okay.
Before we get to the scriptures themselves, just be aware of this, that Josephus claimed, Josephus was that Jewish historian in the first century, Josephus claimed that Daniel was made a eunuch along with the other 3 Jews. I don't know what his foundations were for that, so there's no weight here. It's just the fact that he did say that, and he was about 2,000 years closer to the thing than we are. But there is something else. I want you to go back to Isaiah, and it'll be significant here in a minute why I want you to go back to that. Isaiah 39. In Isaiah 39, my Ryrie Study Bible titles this chapter "The Stupidity of Hezekiah." So that's just the chapter heading. It's not inspired. But nonetheless, Hezekiah pulled a real boner, because Hezekiah had been sick and had recovered, and there was a king of Babylon that sent letters and a present to him, and apparently he was, you know, concerned about his condition, and this is before Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar and all that. Okay, so Hezekiah is pleased, and he takes the people that have come and shows them all his treasure house and the silver and the gold and the spices and the precious oil and his whole army and everything he had. He showed it to them. It says, nor in all his dominion Hezekiah did not show them. There was nothing in his house or in all his dominion that he didn't show them. So then Isaiah comes to King Hezekiah in verse 3 and says, "What are these men saying? From where have they come to you?" And Hezekiah said, "Well, they've come to me from a far country, from Babylon." What have they seen in your house?" He said, "They've seen everything. There's nothing among my treasures that I haven't shown them." And Isaiah said to Hezekiah, "Hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and all that your fathers have laid up in store to this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord. Now here, that's a prophecy of Daniel 1. And a little bit later, in 589 or somewhere along in there. But it says, in verse 7, some of your sons who shall issue from you, whom you shall beget, shall be taken away, and they shall become eunuchs. It's again translated by the NASB officials. They shall become eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon, or officials. And Hezekiah said, well, it's not going to happen in my days. I'm not going to worry about it. I mean, you know, typical self-centered attitude. The question is, did the translators translate in chapter 39, verse 7, they should become officials in the palace of the king? They deliberately did not choose to go with eunuchs. Now, I think that's important when we go into chapter 56 of Isaiah. In Isaiah 56, there are two references to this word translated eunuchs or officials. It says in verse 1, preserve justice and do righteousness, for my salvation is about to come and my righteousness to be revealed. How blessed is the man who does this and the son of man who takes hold of it, who keeps from profaning the Sabbath and keeps his hand from doing any evil. Now, verse 3 says, let not the foreigner who has joined himself to the Lord say, the Lord will surely separate me from his people. Neither let the eunuch say, behold, I'm a dry tree. Now, this is the same words translated official just a few chapters earlier. Now, why'd they go with eunuch? Because of what he wasn't supposed to say. What was it that he wasn't supposed to say? I'm a dry tree. What's that mean? No fruit bearing. It's incapable of bearing fruit. So they had to go with eunuch here. I mean, it was obvious. You don't say, don't let the official say, behold, I'm a dry tree. And then in verse 4, for thus says the Lord to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths and choose what pleases me and hold fast my covenant, to them I will give in my house and within my walls a memorial, a name better than that of sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name which will not be cut off. Now, you don't understand, perhaps, the significance of that statement, verses 4 and 5. Why would he address the eunuchs who keep his Sabbath and do what pleases him? Well, you have to remember that the eunuchs were barred by the law from worshiping in the temple. They couldn't go up to the temple. They were treated as outcasts because they were blemished men, and in the law, things that had blemishes were ostracized. That's why the lamb had to be without spot and blemish. The leper had to be ostracized. He couldn't be in the community. He had lived out there with the other lepers. And the eunuchs were in that category too. And so the Lord says to those people who are ostracized, if they keep my Sabbaths and choose what pleases me and hold fast my covenant, I will give them in my house and within my walls a memorial, a name better than the sons and daughters. I'll give them an everlasting name. So here Isaiah twice uses the same word that the translators opted for in chapter 39 to call officials, but here it's very clear that Isaiah's use of that word meant eunuch. So I would argue that we need to go back to chapter 39 and change the word official to eunuch. That's the way I would argue.
NIV uses eunuch.
Huh?
The NIV.
In chapter 39.
Yeah, they use
eunuch. Well, I think that's legitimate because it's what you call a consistent author in the same book using the same word. Why do the translators think they have the freedom to translate it with one English word in one place, and then when they can't get out of it, translate it according to its origins in the next two places? I think that there is a prejudice against the notion that God would allow people to be made eunuchs. But Jesus frankly said in the New Testament, you know, there are some people who are made eunuchs by others, and there are some who make themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom. And in both cases, he's talking about people who refuse or are incapable of. He may be using those that are made eunuchs by others as an actual physical castration issue, but those that make themselves eunuchs may simply be referring to people who absolutely refuse to be sexually active and they remain single all their lifetime for the sake of their ministry calling. In any case, we really do have an issue here. And so I believe that chapter 39, if you go back to that, Isaiah was telling Hezekiah that the king of Babylon was going to come and take some of his sons and daughters, and he was going to take those sons to Babylon and make them eunuchs. And lo and behold, you get to Daniel, and Nebuchadnezzar comes to Jerusalem and besieges it, and the Lord hands the city over to him, and so he takes some of the vessels of the house of God, brings them to the land of Shinar, and he also brings some of the sons of Israel that he has brought hostage into Babylon. And then he gives Ashpenaz, who is a eunuch, but he's the top eunuch in the group, a charge to bring some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, and be under his oversight for the next 3 years and do several things that he wants done. But the implication is pretty straightforward, that Daniel and his three friends are subject to this prophecy that Isaiah gave Hezekiah. So I think the word does say that, in effect, Josephus was right. That's my reasoning. I'm not going to rest my salvation on it. But it seems to me that one of the issues in this chapter, in chapter 1, one of the issues is this contrast between the way Daniel was treated in Babylon and his loyalty to God in chapter 1. Because it's really unusual. You know what the typical American Christian does today when things go wrong? Gets mad at God, quits praying, quits going to church, quits reading his Bible, quits doing anything that has anything to do with God because he's mad at him. And the typical response to God treating us in ways we don't want to be treated is hostility toward him on our part. It's not legitimate. I kind of cringe every time I hear somebody talk about being mad at God. And I say, well, you can be mad at God if you want to, but I'm going to... It ain't going to be fruitful for you. What do you want to be mad at God for? There's two really good reasons for not being mad at God. Number one, you can't win that way. He ain't intimidated by our anger. And number two, he loves us. Well, why would you want to be mad at him? Well, he didn't do what I wanted him to do. Well, that's just your selfishness. You ought to be mad at yourself for acting like that. But the point, I think, in the chapter is that Israel had come to a time of great apostasy under Jehoiakim, and you weren't going to find very many of them being loyal to God in any way, and under any circumstances, but particularly the ones that he's allowed to be hauled off into captivity, because the situation in chapter 1 of Daniel is the original incursion by Babylon over Jerusalem. This did not result in the destruction of Jerusalem or the destruction of the temple. Eliakim was king for 11 years, and this was in his third year. And it wasn't until when he died and his son was made king for 3 months, he rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. And then the crash came, and then the city was destroyed, and the walls were broken down, the temple was destroyed, and all that kind of thing. So what we have here is, in the initial setting, Nebuchadnezzar took some of the children of the high-level rulers in Judah, some of Eliakim's or Jehoiakim's children, some of the nobles of the kingdom, some of their children. He took them hostages. He took them away so that these rulers would not rebel against Babylon. And then his plan, according to this paragraph, was to incorporate these youth into the rulership of the kingdom of Babylon. so that Judea would become a kind of a buffer territory for the kingdom of Babylon, because it was between Babylon and Egypt, and it would become kind of a buffer sub-kingdom. And he allowed the king of Judea to stay the king. He allowed him to do that. He levied some penalties on him and that kind of thing, but nonetheless, it wasn't until the rebellion that happened later that he actually removed that king and put another in his place. So the whole point here is, we're talking about the intrigue of the king of Babylon trying to force the Jews to become loyal to him and to his gods. So, when we ask the question, who was Ashpenaz? Well, I think he was the head eunuch, and I think that Daniel and his three friends were subjected to the same process that made them eunuchs. But look at the instructions that are given to Ashpenaz by the king. He's supposed to be, well, on the second page I'm giving you the, there's no particular reason to think that Daniel was not so mistreated by the Babylonians, because Daniel knew the promise of Isaiah 56, 4 and 5, that the eunuchs that please the Lord will be given a better name than sons and daughters. And then I stuck in this, if any man exemplified 1 Peter 4, 1, Daniel was such a man. You know what 1 Peter 4, 1 says? That he that has suffered has ceased from sin. Now, that has to be understood in its own context, but one of the things it's not saying is that if you are mistreated or badly treated, that it'll make you stop sinning. Sometimes it makes you start sinning in a worse way because you get hostile toward God and you refuse to be submissive to Him, you refuse to trust Him, refuse to give thanks, and on and on and on and on and on. But if there was ever a man whose mistreatment caused him to be more loyal to God, Daniel was such a man, and Ezekiel 14:14 and 20 clearly say that, because in Ezekiel 14, Ezekiel holds up Noah and Job and Daniel as the three most godly men of history. He says, these three guys are so righteous that they could deliver themselves by their righteousness, but they couldn't deliver anybody else. So he was holding these three guys up as the most righteous men in all human history, Noah and Job and Daniel. Daniel knew those verses in Ezekiel. Ezekiel was a prophet to the exiles, a contemporary of Daniel. So the whole point here is, I think that there's a strong issue in the first chapter that is a contrast between the way Daniel was treated and the loyalty that he then rendered to God, because verse 8 declares that. That's the next paragraph, which we'll get to in a week or two. But what were the instructions that Ashpenaz was actually given? Well, he was supposed to take the cream of the crop of the children of Israel that had been brought into Babylon, and he was to put them in a program that would make it possible for them to become special servants to the king. And these best of the children were the children of the king and the children of the nobles and so forth. And these best were supposed to be unblemished, well-favored, and significantly intelligent. That means they had to be really good-looking and smart. But these best were to be capable of learning all things Chaldean, including their language. That's what verse 4 tells us, that they would be good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and had ability for serving in the king's court, and he ordered him to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. And that's the reason why Daniel is easily able in chapter 2 to shift over to the language of the Chaldeans and write six chapters for the Chaldeans, the Babylonians' sake. But there was another thing he was supposed to do. He was to provide these best with a daily ration from the king's choice food and the wine which he drank, and they were to be educated 3 years, and then they were to enter into the king's service. Now, verse 5 becomes the catalyst for verses 8 and following. because the assignment of the food and the drink were problematical for Daniel in his way of looking at things. And we'll get into that when we get to the next paragraph. But the issue in verses 6 and 7 are the particular individuals. Only four out of all of these young men that were selected by Ashpenaz are named and identified. It says in verse 6, among these from the sons of Judah, so these were all Judahites, were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And then he switches to the word commander. Then the commander of the eunuchs. Why does he do that? Why does he go from being the top eunuch to the commander of the eunuchs? My argument is that he calls him, in verse 3, the highest of the eunuchs, which identifies him as a eunuch. But then he uses the word as typically translated in some kind of way that indicates leadership. Sometimes it's translated captain, sometimes king, sometimes governor, depending on what your context is. But the word that's translated commander here actually means somebody who's in charge. And so since the task is that he's been given this three-year task by the king, he is no longer being looked at as the top eunuch. He's being looked at the eunuch who has the responsibility to carry out these instructions. That's why he switches the word. And from here on, like I said, six times in this chapter, I mean, it's over and over. Verse 8, commander of the officials. Verse 9, side of the commander of the official. Verse 10, the commander of the official. Verse 11, commander of the official. Why does he just say Ashpenaz? This is one of those issues of literary design where you're talking about a focus. And the focus here is on the instructions that have been given by the king and how that's going to affect Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The first thing that affects is that the prince of the eunuchs, or the commander of the eunuchs, or the main authority figure of the eunuchs, changes their names.
It appears that they had no choice. When you say commander, you have to obey.
Well, and that's the basic idea of the word just being translated commander. It means somebody in authority. He's given you, yeah.
And that makes it even more so when Daniel said, wait a minute.
Yeah.
He was bucking not only him, but the king.
Well, and as the commander of the officials tells him, you're putting my life at risk. So, yeah, it does emphasize the fact that these are non-negotiable demands. And one of the first things he does is assign them a new name. Now, we've already talked about that assignment of name business. You remember when Pharaoh Necho changed Eliakim's name to Jehoiakim? The whole issue of giving somebody a name is you're putting them under your authority. In fact, in a sense, you own them. They have to do what you tell them. And it's really interesting what he did to them, because he took each one of them. The word Daniel either means a judge of God or God is judge. There's a little difference in the way you would take that, but in Hebrew it's hard to tell where the focus is in a single word. The word El at the end of the word Daniel means that El is judge. And if you remember, the tribe of Dan was the idea there was because of judgment. So Dan El meant God is judge, or he is a judge of from God. But in any case, the focus there is on Daniel being connected to God in some respect to judgment, and Ashpenaz changes his name to Belteshazzar. Now, the king in chapter 5, Belshazzar, the only difference between Belteshazzar and Belshazzar is the T-E. But the basic idea of Belteshazzar is unclear. In the sources that I had available to me, they didn't go into the Babylonian Chaldean language thing, and they just said it's a foreign origin. But we do know that Bel was one of the chief gods of Babylon. And the idea of the verb Shazar had something to do with protection. So the suggestion is that the god Bel was supposed to be in some way the protector. And that may have been a deliberate attempt to change Daniel's identity as a person who's under God's judgment or discernment or decision making and put him under Bel's. The deliberate. We're going to get rid of this El that you call Yahweh. You're now under the authority of Bel. And it was a deliberate challenge. It's trying to erase Daniel's identity and replace it with a new name. And remember, the promise to the eunuchs of Hezekiah's offspring from God was, I'm going to give them a name. But this isn't it. And then the name Hananiah, which is a word that ends in A-H, which means it's a reference to Yahweh. Hananiah means Yahweh's gracious. It's basically a Hebrew base for the New Testament John, Yohane, Yahweh's gracious. But he's named Shadrach, which means something along the line of the servant of Aku, which is the Babylonian god, the moon god. And the idea there was that he was, instead of being loyal to Yahweh who was gracious to him, he was now the servant of the moon god. He had to be loyal to him. And that's a challenge to Yahweh's provision by making Aku the one whose commands were to provide with the person with his direction and so on. Mishael, the M-I at the beginning of Mishael is the Hebrew question who or what, and El is at the end is the reference to God. So who is God or what is God? And since, you know, the Jews had a personal thing, is who is God? Question mark. And we talked about that's the issue in deciding who you're going to worship. Who is God? And he was renamed Meshach. And that is who is Aku. It's deliberate. He's pretty obviously trying to shift these boys' identity from what they are under Yahweh, El of Israel, or Judah, to Baal or Aku or any number of other Babylonian gods. And then Azariah means Yahweh helps. And he was renamed Abednego or Abednego, servant of Nebo, who is the god of wisdom. And only wisdom's all that really helps. So, I mean, you know, with all you're getting, get wisdom. Get understanding. The whole idea there is wisdom is even personified in the book of Proverbs as if it's God. So who's going to be the god of wisdom? Is it going to be Yahweh? No, it's Nebo. So what we actually have here in this paragraph is that Nebuchadnezzar has a plan to Babylonize. You'll not find that in the dictionary anywhere. But he's going to try to Babylonize the Judean youths so that they will serve him and his gods. He's trying to brainwash them and get them to embrace Babylonian culture, understanding, wisdom, and their religion. That's the whole point of him bringing them into the king's personal service. Now, just something for you to think about. Nobody really knows how old Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah were when this all took place. But it's probable that they were in their mid-teens, somewhere between 14 and 18. And the reason that I say that is because 70 years later, Daniel's still around, which would make him either 84, 85, 86. And then he goes into the Medo-Persian Empire under the king of the Medes and then under the king of the Persians, Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian. So, you know, he's pushing 90 years old by the time this book is being written. So they couldn't have been too much
older
than that. Because, you know, this is way after Moses said that your lifespan's 70, and if by reason of strength, 80. So we can't expect that Daniel's going to live you know, to be much, I mean, he might live to be 100, but not really likely. So what we have here is junior high school age boys who are being subjected to all of the skill and wisdom and teaching and literature and everything Babylonian, even having their names changed and having to learn the new language and being instructed in all of the arts of the Babylonians, which included astrology and astronomy, and they stayed loyal. But there were only four of them that did. The rest of them kind of washed out. So that's something for us to think about in terms of the way we look at our young people and stuff. It's not the culture that's the danger to them. It's not the influences of the culture around them that's the danger to them. It's their lack of a biblical grounding to start with. Daniel didn't come to this faith early on. I mean, he didn't come to this faith because he'd been hauled off into captivity. He apparently had a godly mother or father or both and was raised with understanding, and when he got to Babylon, he decided he was going to be faithful to God. And that's the real issue for all of our young people. It's not what they're subjected to out there, exposed to. What needs to be done is for them to be firmly grounded in a real relationship with God.